Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
My name is Mike Boris, and I've teamed up with Stake, one of Australia's top investing platforms, to talk about going public. IPOs are exciting milestones that unlock new capital, draw more attention, and open up opportunities. But a lot happens before and after the trading bell rings, and it's not all glamour. Join me in candid conversations with prominent business leaders as we reveal all the ups and downs of getting a private company listed. James Graham, welcome to Going Public.
Hi, Mark. Good to be with you.
So you're a pretty young CEO, but you are the CEO and one of the founding investors of Recce Pharmaceuticals, listed on the ASX.
That's right, yes.
Righto. Do you mind if I get a little bit of history about you? Because you're pretty young,
yeah.
So young CEO.
Look, I may be young chronologically, but I feel a little old, and I think I've done quite a bit in my time. And really, Recce started where I was the founding investor, supporting my grandfather to get out of his garage into a proper laboratory to have a go. I'm not a pharmaceutical guy, I'm a commercial guy, and I come from a place where I actually had a commercial success in my very early 20s, totally unrelated industry. Pharmaceuticals as a product, the business fundamentals remain the same. And that was really at the time where I helped him get out of that garage into a lab and identify the ideal compound to tackle that global health threat of antibiotic resistance.
Okay, so this is your grandfather, your pop. So,
yeah, my pop, that's what I call him, yeah.
Yeah, and what's he doing trying to tackle a global health product in relation to, as I understand it, this is an antibiotic.
It is. We call it an anti-infective. It's a compound, yeah. Right. So an anti-infective, antibiotics are particular to bacteria. You should never use an antibiotic for viruses.
Yep.
But we are attracted to the proteinaceous layer of viral cells as well. So we're very effective in that capacity too.
So, okay, we should get a little bit into the weeds. So, and I'll talk about you in a moment. But what was your grandfather doing? Like, what was the problem he was trying to solve?
Look, he was former head of Johnson & Johnson Research Australasia for 10 years. In fact, he kind of invented the No More Tears baby shampoo, and he definitely invented some of the baby oils and things. So a really inventive capacity and executive director of the board's a third of the globe responsibilities. From that time, he went on to create an animal antibiotic company. The company was the best performing stock on the ASX for the early 2000s, 3 years straight. And at the time, I was in my early high school days, and I was a real scallywag. I left school in year 9. So Pop kind of took me under his wing, and I watched this company go from $1 billion to 3.5 years after he retired, where they changed the business model. He fell on his face in the public media. And I thought that was grossly unfair. The guy's brilliantly capable, and really with that capability and inventive mindset, when he puts his mind to the challenge of hypercellular mutation, which is just bacteria evolving, they evolve to mutate, or they mutate to survive. He wanted to create a compound that's not found in nature, as all existing antibiotics are, to overcome that and break a lot of the challenged business model and the economics of antibiotic manufacture. And he really did that. And I thought, look, if he's dedicated enough to get back out there on the street in his 80s at that time and have a go, and if he says this thing's probably got antibiotic properties, being this little vial that he had, it probably does. And that's good enough for me.
Crazy. It's crazy, James. Like, what was he like? He worked at J&J, Johnson & Johnson, the pharma group.
Yep.
Was he a Was he a chemist or what?
You're absolutely
his deal?
Right. Polymeric chemistry. In fact, he tells a great story. His very first job out of university was in Dulux Paints. He says he and one other were in the R&D department. His buddy in that department went on to create the Australian banknote, the polymeric banknote. Well, the only real difference is my grandfather's one soluble at pH of the blood to the opposite acidity of the stomach. The antibacterial properties remain the same. Broadly, of course, they're quite different, but you get the philosophy. So polymeric inventor, meaning polymer is a small string of beads, essentially, goes larger, it stays on your skin, goes smaller, passes through your skin layer. And that inventive step, of course, being a polymer expert, is where that skill set comes in.
Polymer being like a plastic.
Like a plastic, exactly. But plastics aren't soluble. The solubility and absorption is critical. But yes, it's exactly the same as the plastics space. It's very well said.
So then he has taken this polymer to put it inside our system as opposed to putting it on the outside of our system.
Yeah, we can go on too, or on.
I have actually had a polymer put into a tendon.
Oh, okay,
it's sewn into a tendon to reattach a tendon to a bone, which reattaches the muscle to the body.
I think I know
I've been through the process. Mm. But yours, what your pop was doing was a soluble one.
Correct.
So how did he... I mean, I don't want to get too deep into science, but what was he thinking? I'm going to turn this into something that's going to attack infections as opposed to viruses.
That's right. It's really bacterial focus. So the commonality of bacteria as opposed to other cells is they have a proteinaceous layer on the cell wall. So I try not to get too deep into science, but
that's okay.
That's what it's attracted to.
So the bacterial cell
have a protein layer.
A protein layer covering the cell.
Correct. And this compound is hyper attracted to the protein.
Your pop's compound.
Yes, that's right. Well, it's Recce's compound, of course, is the whole poly invented. And it binds to that and then it interacts with that. Now, what he basically did is he looked to the world of antibacterials, and there's a material called acrolein. One part in a million in smoke stings your eyes. That's acrolein. It's a useless way, but it's extremely one, explosive, and two, active. And
so it's volatile.
Volatile is a much better term. Yeah. If you can take that volatility, stabilize it, and utilize the antibacterial properties, which have been well known in that compound for well over 100 years, you have a stable antibacterial compound. And through the process of synthesis, all existing antibiotics known to date are naturally derived. They're found, they're cultivated out, they're used. There's no invention in that. This is first principles in mind, designed with what you want, not reliant on what's given to you in nature. And he created that.
And I guess the reason it's volatile is because of its the compound has atoms in it which have they're missing a few electrons or something along those lines, and they're in the way they've combined.
That's exactly it. It is how you. It's exactly as you say. It's how they combine. That's very smart, Mark. Actually, yes, it's exactly how they bind together, and that stabilization of binding them creates a stable compound.
Yep.
But for what it's worth, the main compound 327 is Scientific Journal number 3, page 27. That's a lot of inventions to try to work out the ideal compound. It doesn't just happen overnight.
So he sort of put this together in his garage.
Factually, yes. Of course, you know, our corporate advisors say, don't say it came from a garage, it came from an institute.
Or a lab.
Or a lab, yeah, exactly.
But that was his lab. I mean, a lab can be in a garage, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, look, he realistically, you know, when you're an old, very, very senior, mature age man, however you'd say it politely, your kids are left home. You've had your loving wife for the majority of your life, so only so much conversation you can have there. All your mates are dead and you sleep a lot less. So they actually end up sitting there bored, thinking about something that they see as some value. And I think a little bit of altruism perhaps comes together at the end of their life going, look, I've made my money. I should probably go and do something useful. And that is to try to give back, and fundamentally creating this compound is doing that.
So your family owned...
Prior well, it was about 100%, and now it's down to about 35-40.
But your family owned these rights, or this these patent rights, or these property rights in relation to, let's call it the invention.
Yes,
in an intellectual property sense.
Correct. Yeah.
So
you create a company, and it's vended into the company.
Right. So just take me through what happened. So here's a valuable asset.
Yep.
Which your family owns, but of course, you know, to develop it, you need to raise money. And you need to get investors. How did you took this asset and you vended, as you said,
yes,
into a an entity that was capable of raising money from other investors. So did you go and see lawyers? What'd you do?
The quickest thing in this space is to get R&D rebates. So if you're spending your own money, as we were doing to start with, you want a little bit of that money back, or you want to extend your cash runway. So you can't, as an individual, claim R&D. So you immediately put it into
an R&D being research and development research grant. Development. It's
well,
a grant.
It's a rebate. Yeah, so it's a, I love the term grant, but it's a rebate.
Correct. There's a rebate of tax for the future.
Yeah, basically. But you get the cash. It's a cash now. Correct. So caveat free.
Just so I understand, and I think it's important to explain this to the audience. Yeah. So if you spend $1 million on building this qualified asset relative to the so-called rebate, the government, Australian government, will give you a percentage of that back.
Yes, 43.5%.
But which means that when in the future, when you start to make money, you can no longer claim that as a tax deduction. So you're sort of getting your tax deduction in advance.
If my understanding, to what I recall, as long as it's an R&D expense, so R&D applicable expense,
it qualifies.
You can still have a very, very profitable company. I think Cochlear is the biggest one. They're clearly very profitable. Our biggest claim of the R&D expenditure expenses to date
is Cochlear.
Cochlear.
Yeah. And did you, so you guys vended this asset into this company?
So you immediately want to create a company. It's in your personal interest too. Mm. So for every dollar that you spend, you're then going to, assuming it's all R&D applicable, which broadly at that time it is, you get extra 43.5 cents in every dollar you spend. That's very attractive because not only does it increase your financial runway, it's non-dilutionary cash, meaning it doesn't affect your
You don't have to issue more shares to somebody else.
No, that's right. Exactly. Yeah. And you get to, basically vend in more when it's theoretically it is for the collective good of that company. But what you'll find is everyone only has so much depth to their own personal capital, regardless of, you only want to commit so much. And frankly, it actually is a very good validator to bring in other investors in the process as well.
Investors like the R&D anyway. They like that.
They like it. We like it. I mean, I personally invested another $410,000 on market last year, and I don't like a capital raise as much as anyone else.
Yeah, correct. So you put it into this company called Recce.
Yep.
Probably at that stage was proprietary limited, or was it limited?
It was proprietary. So Recce stands for reconnaissance, for what it's worth. It's an army term. He was in the army, and he was marksman. He's deaf from all the rifle shooting. But a good reconnaissance is you get in behind enemy lines, you eliminate the enemy, you get out without being noticed. In pharmaceuticals, the ideal compound, you get into the human body, you eliminate the infection, and you get out without side effects. So that's really where that Recce.
Oh, that's cool.
It was Recce proprietary limited.
Start off as a private.
Very private. Company. Pop and I having a go. Then my auntie got involved. And then just because we happen to be all related by blood, it stops there. It is a ruthless business in families. Yeah.
So should be.
We keep each other honest.
Because you've got to, you've got to get returns for all shareholders, including yourselves.
You do.
But every shareholder.
Yep.
I won't go down yet the path to going public just yet.
Sure.
I just want to find out a little bit about how did you go about things like FDA approvals or, TGA approvals how did you fund those processes and what has been your testing regime, in other words, to proof of concept.
Absolutely.
To start with, and then you've got your then you have to be able to show, 10,000 people. I don't know how many people you have to show to have used this where it's been effective. Where do you get this lab testing done? So can you take me through some of that?
Yeah, look, so in pharmaceuticals, just taking a big back step, the first thing you have to do is you prove it in a dish, then you prove it in a preclinical setting, so in animals, it's a necessary evil, and only then, and all the regulators and everyone has to look very thoroughly at it, can you have any interaction with a human. So the first investments were actually focused upon two things. One, identifying the optimum compound. I mentioned R327, so Scientific Journal, page 27. And then demonstrating that from a patentability perspective. So if you look to the challenges, or to get a patent, it's got to be commercially useful, not suggested by prior art, so totally new and novel, and contain an inventive step among a couple of others. So we went, okay, the challenge in antibiotics or antibacterials is hypercellular mutation or overcoming superbugs. So we went, well, what's the regime to prove that this can do that? So you expose the compound, being the compounds to multiple different types of bacteria, and you expose the most commercially relevant compound in that area, which is amoxicillin, sells at about $10 billion per annum, and you show that we work and keep on working with repeated use. Amoxicillin doesn't, penicillin doesn't, all the other cillins don't.
The cells mutate.
Correct. They always have, they always will. And what that does is it shows that our compound is able to be commercially useful. It contains an inventive step. It's something that's not suggested by any prior art. And that, therefore, when you have a 20-year market exclusivity that comes with a granted patent status, obviously for a period of time it was pending and then it was granted. We now have over 50 granted patents around the world. You have something that you can go, it's not just us saying it. It's been demonstrated through this scientific method. It's been authenticated by independent examiners. And then you go around to your regulators in answering a question and go, all of these nice incentives that you have to promote developing new antibiotics, we appeal to many of those. So how about the qualified infectious disease designation awarded by the FDA? Add a 10 years market exclusivity above and beyond patent position, plus expedited regulatory review. And to my knowledge, we're the only one in the world for that for sepsis. So it's a really good validator.
Yeah, let's just talk about the sepsis for a second. It is a global problem.
Isn't it?
The number of people I know of who've just last 2 months who have got a staph infection their bloodstream off scratches.
That's sepsis, absolutely.
Just scratches on their body. Yep. Like not out of a hospital. They just got it in a gym and
just
stuff like that.
Just bump yourself on the table.
Totally. Yep. It's just amazing. I don't know whether it's just something because I'm getting older and I know people are older or whatever, but I just
no, it's...
And seriously ill from it, like very ill from it.
1 in 5 death rate, quite literally according to the statistics. I've been a sepsis patient. I didn't intend to be. I got attacked by a dog. I didn't provoke it, but it did happen. And that it was 2 weeks IV antibiotics in a hospital. Horrible.
Well, so even someone in my family recently got it just because she had a mole removed and next thing you know, she was in the hospital 3 days later.
Wow.
And it's pretty significant. So
yes.
your compound has application to sepsis or to the bacteria that causes sepsis, which is generally speaking, it's a staphylococcus bacteria.
Probably the most common is, any bacteria in your blood is bad bacteria, and it doesn't matter how it gets in there. As you say, it can be a basic operation, it can be an accident, it can be anything. And the likelihood of survival decreases by 8% each hour the patient isn't treated.
Wow.
The challenge is if you do have staph, well, you might have Pseudomonas, you might have E. coli, you might have something else. I'll give you a staph antibiotic, not knowing what you have, because the pathology blood draw will take 24, 48 hours, and you won't survive because that antibiotic is only useful against that bacteria.
Right.
We don't care what type of bacteria you have, or the patient has, of course. We work faster than any other antibiotic to date, and we work broader than any other antibiotic known to date. And that means we can remove the guesswork, clinical guesswork up front, and get on top of that infection at first patient presentation.
So pardon me if I my ignorance on this, but
no, you're doing well.
Does that mean the polymer in your compound polymer?
Yes,
actually encases the bacteria so that it can't reproduce. Is that what happens?
I laughed at myself slightly because, frankly, when we started, we had a theory and we thought our theory was that. But it turns out we actually enter the cell. So antibiotics, I should say, survive through, they create lipid outer layers, all sorts of gooiness to them. So it's a defense mechanism. Somehow, and I say somehow because we still can't totally work out how the best scientists in the world are trying, we permeabilize the cell. So we actually enter the channels of the cell. Cells breathe. They're like a human body in a lot of ways where they expel rubbish and all the rest of it and take in nutrients. We enter the cell and we shut down what's called the ATP synthesis of the cell, or the beating heart.
The energy.
The energy, exactly. Very well done. And we shut that down faster than any other antibiotic known today. We shut it down irreversibly. And we get out under a cloak.
Does it smother it, or do you
it just turns it off. It can't be revived. There's a lot of deep research into how and why. And we also stop the Z-ring complex or the cell division complex, which is simply infection spreading. We stop that irreversibly. How? Don't really know, to be perfectly honest.
Probably doesn't matter that much. But
well, what matters is it works. And it works across the full. In fact, escape pathogens is the acronym for 80% of the deadliest bacterial species in the world. We are clinically the most advanced escape pathogen company in the world.
Wow. So, okay. So, I mean, I can imagine why investors are excited by this. So here you got this great story and really does solve not just a theoretical problem in a science sense, which is going to get maybe, you know, someone like Nature or whatever wants to publish it, but it's actually solving a real problem, like a real world problem.
It's an actual issue. It's not something we made up. And the market, because bacterial resistance grows every day, well, it's a growing market. The antibiotic pipeline's never been drier. The need has never been greater. It's very commercially attractive.
So you're sitting around and at the family table and you've got this compound and it's doing all these great things in terms of the various stages of testing.
Yep.
When did you decide to go to the market?
We went to
raise money. I'm sorry.
Yes, to do an IPO. We did the IPO. So I didn't start in the company to get a job. I had a job. I had just every company is difficult in its own way. So despite it being a commercial success, it was really challenging. So I just finished that, and then I'd invested and helped my pop. You know, I carried all the stuff out to the lab, and I'd go and see him every day. But it didn't become a job until early 2015. And the job was where I actually technically got a title because I actually became an employee. And I then went with Pop to select a board. You have to have a board naturally. We did have a board, but it was not to good corporate governance standards and all the usual rigmarole you need. We wrote a prospectus. We lodged that with the ASX, and we formally listed on the exchange January of 2016.
Did you get a sponsor?
We, if I understand correctly, we had a stockbroker. Yep. We did, and they converted all their commission to stock. So they and actually invested double the amount in their own cash.
Right.
So they did very well.
So you had a sponsor broker.
Yep.
They helped you put. There's a lot of corporate rigmarole around this stuff, but they helped you put the documentation up to the ASX in order to get listed.
Yeah, you go through the DD committees and all the usual. Yeah, it's a big process.
It's a big process.
You know it well.
I know it well. Yeah. It's a big process, but it's valuable because you're accessing an investor market who might want liquidity in what they invest. And that's the main thing.
Liquidity is everything. Yep. Liquidity. The other challenge you have is if you remain private, of course, your capital pools are narrow. But frankly, for up until recently, but even less so nevertheless, there's not a lot of venture in Australian capital. Plenty of capital. Everyone's got money. Very few want a venture capital, aka a private equity side. And very few of those few want a little biotech trying to have a go. And frankly, antibiotics have been a challenged business case for their own reasons. We're breaking that business model and all the rest of it, but still difficult. And they don't normally come in passively. They come in for like 50% of the company. And their interests are not always in the best interests of that compound actually getting to market. They'll package it up, they'll flip it, they'll burn it, they'll do whatever they need to do, but it's not about the good commercial metrics that come with scientific development
and time.
In my personal view, and time.
It's not necessarily patient capital is probably what you're saying.
It's venture in that capital.
Yeah.
And it's also often people who don't have any idea what they're really doing are the biggest opinionated people going around. If they had any idea, they'd be doing it, but they don't. So they come in, try to tell you how to run your business, but really, you know, it doesn't always end up well. So we issued less stock by going onto the ASX. You don't need to issue 50% of the company. I think we issued like 20% maybe. And you frankly get a platform. You get a media profile, and it means when you do have these discoveries, you have an obligation through the ASX, which has an opportunity to communicate through the public market sector as well.
So one of the things I often see as complex is how do you work out when you say you're going to issue, say, 20% of the stock to the public, how you work out what that 20% is of, so the valuation. So and let's say, you know, you're not selling your product or your compound around the world at this stage because it hasn't gone through all the hoops. How do you do a valuation? I mean, what did you guys, did you bring in Deloitte or KPMG or how did you go about this?
Look, the truthful answer is probably not the answer that is supposed to be said. And the truthful answer is, frankly, you make it up.
Well, that's the most common most people do.
Yeah. The reality is something that is pre-revenue, pre-clinical, we're only in animals, so lab bench and a few animals at that stage, and years from a very high risk. Sepsis is the number one most expensive in health, double the second most. There are no therapies for that. So you're going through a pie in the sky. Frankly, you're selling hopes and dreams. And hopes and dreams have a perceived emotional value, a perceived potential to achieve any of those. And you basically have to factor in what's the market prepared to pay for that.
And you're sitting there with your sponsor broker and you're saying, listen, we're going to issue 20% of $1 billion company for argument's sake. I don't know if that's the right number or not, but that's what
that'd
we think.
Nice.
That's you might say, let's say 100 million. We say, that's what we think it's worth. We think it's worth 100 million. And we want to raise, did you go about saying we want to raise this amount of dollars or we only want to give away this amount of equity?
It's a hybrid of the two, so that always is correlated to the market capitalization of the company. If it's $100 million and you're issuing 20%, you're raising $20 million.
Yep.
I mean, you know these metrics well. We actually had a number of a very small number. There was really two competing brokers, and we ourselves have to determine: are you better to get the better price and the one who might not pull it off, or a less attractive price, but you know they're going to hit their targets. And sometimes it's better to take the bird in the hand, which is the not necessarily the short-term pain for long-term gain. So we did things like we put in performance shares to lose. So what equity we lost today, taking a worse price, if we did deliver, we'd make up through performance share.
You being the family.
We being the family, yep. Correct. Yep. So there's a variety of ways of going about that.
And when you're doing this, do you – before you list, but during the listing process, going public process, do you, James, say to the sponsoring brokers, look, you're the people that you're going to talk to about investing in our company, you can tell them that I'm going to work for nothing or I'm going to work for X amount of dollars. I mean, how do you go about telling them what you should be compensated for the time that you spend on this going forward?
Yeah, it's really difficult, to be honest, because the biggest challenge that actually happened when I mentioned the performance shares is if they are achieved, which we did achieve the majority of those
milestones,
correct? It's then an immediate tax event
for you,
for me.
Yeah, now but not having received the cash.
Well, that's right, but exactly. So therefore, the impact is I have like a couple of million dollars of tax and I get paid, like this is at the time, a couple of million dollars of tax with a salary of $75,000. Oh, I'm screwed.
Yeah. Well, unless you sell the shares.
Correct.
Or borrow against
which
them.
Is, so the shareholder wants it on a today value, meaning that all sounds good, but the tomorrow outcome is I either have to borrow against the shares, which is difficult for an IPO because there's very few free float, or I sell shares, which everybody's going to go ballistic. So you actually set yourself up for a really difficult situation.
Yeah.
Now, I had to go through all sorts of challenging ways of compensating for that. I didn't sell the stock. I had to do payment plans and a whole bunch of different pieces. But that is the reality that sometimes the founder is better to be compensated and kept happy.
A wage, a salary,
or whatever's appropriate in their circumstance. So, you know, if they're having a difficult time at home, the company may, no, I'm making this up, it wasn't related to me, but the company may sponsor a gym membership and a basic living accommodation because that would just hold that person together for a period of time. That's an extrapolated example, but buried into a salary can be other benefits to keep that person the best that they can be for the company's benefit.
And the bottom line is everyone's got to think this stuff through. That's the bottom line. It's just, you get performance shares and then you get the shares and all of a sudden that's deemed to be an income for you.
They don't care for their side. Yeah. It's that's the individual. A problem for you. I care.
But they do care. Well, they will care because if that puts you under pressure,
correct,
that's a problem for the company and ultimately.
Exactly right. And the pressure is immense and the company can't do anything to help you. The shareholders, they don't care. It's not their problem. It's a really difficult time, that time. And that experience is a true experience I went through.
Which is why you need a really good sponsoring broker who can sort of go talk you through these processes to tell you what the potential issues are going to be. Either that or listen to this podcast.
That would be ideal. They generally think for themselves and how the IPO is going to be priced. But
correct.
Yeah.
And then how can they earn their fee?
Correct.
Whether it's in cash or whether it's in terms of stock. So where are you guys at today? So how's that ASX listing performed? That's usual metric, share price. I mean, what's it look like?
Look, I think share price is everything, frankly. I think your person would be asleep at the wheel if they're not watching their share price.
So you issued at what price?
So we issued at 20 cents per share. Yeah. We're currently at 55 cents per share. So
that's a good outcome.
It is a good outcome. So that's certainly an outperformer. We have been as high as $1.88 per share. So that was they were pretty heady times. But really, we're over $100 million in market capitalization. Fidelity, the big global fund, has 7.7% of the company.
So you've got some big instos.
We have some big instos. We have about 5,000 shareholders in total. The top 20 own about 55% of the company, if I've got my numbers right. So there's quite a high tail end component to it, but all shareholders matter, of course. And we are clinically the most advanced new class of antibiotic in the world. World Health Organization are about to state that we're the most capable against their deadly suite of 10 pathogens and getting ahead with multiple clinical programs.
And I mean, generally speaking, biotechs struggle a little bit here, especially on the ASX, because we're not really a biotech environment in Australia.
We're not.
As an investor community.
Invention-wise, we're the best. In fact, antibiotics were initially identified. The discovery was here in Australia. I think it was Alexander Fleming. But the medical use, as they term it, happened overseas. So we saw it, didn't know what to do with it. The people overseas, they knew what to do.
So I would say you guys have performed quite admirably. What's the next step? So from here, where do you want to be in 5 years and say 10 years? How important is it for you, the CEO, to address shareholders and future shareholders? And how often do you have to do that in terms of the runway? So what it looks like in 5 years and 10 years, that process, just take us through that quickly.
Look, it's the fundamental to our existence. I spend 30 to 50% of my time engaging with shareholders, aka either existing or investors. And that seems a little counterintuitive, but if you've got a shareholder base that backs you, believes you, supports you, and also some of those shareholders particularly I really admire. So like I'll have an idea or want to float a thought or something other, and I want a little bit of feedback. Now, I don't have to take their opinion, but I do really value that because some of them are just some of the best business people I've ever come across, and I learn a lot from that. So you keep your shareholder base tight. You share with them what you're thinking in regards to the question of where you want to be in 5 years is a long time in our space, so call it maybe 2 years, and you can clearly see how you're going to be there. And it's a real joy to go through that process. This for us currently is the year of efficacy. So we've shown our compound is safe. We've shown it is well tolerated through multiple methods of administration, but particularly into human veins, so the most invasive. This year we see whether it works, aka it kills the bacteria. Kills all bacteria. There's no such thing as good bacteria in your blood. There's no such thing as good bacteria in your bladder, so UTI infections. And what we've seen in that process just prior to the formalities of these efficacy studies is special access scheme use. You know, frankly, as a young guy, we can be quite self-interested and we can think, oh, I'm going to make a lot of money and this will be great. But when you actually see somebody able to walk on their prosthesis and you know, you go and see them again and they say they walked their kid home from school, it's the first time they've done that.
Without infections
and what that means to them and actually be in the room with them, you kind of feel it. Like, and I didn't expect to feel it like I really have. And that's meaningful, emotionally meaningful, but commercially meaningful as well, because you're going, shit, this, pardon the language, this thing actually worked. And this, if I could extrapolate this across multiple patient categories, what can be good for people can be good for business as well. And that's a really synergistic interest.
So given that Recce has hold of this, what happens in the end? Does Recce then license this technology across the board to say Johnson & Johnson or whoever?
Yeah.
Who gets it? Like, how does a big pharma come in to talk to you? How does it work?
Look, they do. We say, keeping it simple, there's There's a large American one that begins with P. There's a large Swiss one that begins with R. Two major pharmaceutical companies I think we can recognize. And interestingly, what is pharmaceuticals really? They're marketing and distribution and they're cash. We have cash. Marketing and distribution happens at the end of phase three. We're in broadly phase two, so depending on the indication, phase one, phase two. So we're now at that stage of commercial viability, about kind of that 18 months, 24 months from requiring distribution or being interested in distribution, but we don't necessarily need them. And the closer we get to their market, because they currently own that space, we're either a competitive threat to their existing pipeline or for them, an opportunity for them to own or maintain that profitable space. So they're very interested in us.
Yeah, but that does, I sort of speculate all sorts of courses of action once you get over past phase three.
Is it licensed? Is it acquisition? Yeah, yeah. Is the family prepared to sell? I mean, as I said, it's my grandfather's in his early 90s in a nursing home.
He's still alive?
Still alive.
Oh,
but
wow.
He's in a hospital bed. Like he's had a stroke and he's a ruthless warlord. He still barks orders from his hospital bed. And now, of course, I have to listen to all shareholders, not just him, but he is a dictator. And
well, that's
he's very driven.
I can't believe that he's still alive. That's fantastic.
Oh, yeah. In his 90s hospital bed, yeah.
I guess the upside looks pretty good. Like, for some reason, we seem to live in a world of infections today. Like, you get a virus, then you get infection.
The
infections sort of follow everything.
They do.
Bacteria is one of the toughest things that in nature.
They are
so adaptable, so prevalent. On yours and my skin right now.
Absolutely.
All over us.
There's plenty of healthy bacteria. We all have healthy bacteria in our lower intestine. Yep. It's called the microbiome.
Yep.
We avoid the microbiome through a variety of means. But yes, it's even around our nose, by example. They say if you get an infection in this called the deadly triangle or something in that area, you'll be dead really quick. It's straight to your brain.
Yep.
Now, healthy bacteria exists there. It's like an antibiotic effect. So healthy bacteria are basically an antibiotic against the bad bacteria, and they're constantly fighting each other in a state of natural equilibrium. But if one drops away, the healthy bacteria, the other one, the bad bacteria, immediately take over.
Yeah,
and it's that balance. So we don't get in the way of any of that. But of course, we don't want bacteria in your blood, in your bladder, and certain other places. As long as the compound gets there through whatever method of administration, we work and we keep on working with repeated use.
I think just a final question for you, James. I presume it's an injection as opposed to a pill?
For bacterial blood poisoning, so it's sepsis is the technical term, but just think of blood poisoning.
Yep.
That is where the infection site is in your blood.
Yep.
So that is an IV into human vein.
Yep.
If it's a diabetic foot infection or a burn wound infection or a soft tissue infection or a skin infection of some sort, it's a gel or a spray. It's not an IV. You just rub it on the area or you spray it on and it absorbs through the tissue and into the muscle. If it's in your sinuses, you spray it up your nose. It depends on where the infection is.
But the delivery processes is something that's more mechanical than anything.
It is.
And you can sort of, once you prove it up, you can actually engineer that quite readily, I would imagine.
Oh, it's easy. It's just a method of administration. So we regularly have dosed for, as in we have cured people topically, IV, orally, nasally. I'm looking forward to the inhaler side. That'll be good. So things like pneumonia infections, tuberculosis is an area we're looking at. Yeah, through a puffer straight in your lungs or a respirator in the air. That'll be an area. That'll be interesting. That's just one I'm personally looking forward to.
Well, James Graham, this is a great Australian technology, which, by the way, is plenty of it, but a lot of it never actually sees the light of day. Hmm. This is a great Australian technology. You sound like you've got a really good, well put together biotech in the form of Recce Limited. What's your ticker?
RCE.
So RCE, I'm going to go and have a look at it myself. Well done. Congratulations. And thanks very much for coming on to Going Public, mate.
Many thanks, Mark.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.